You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a shortage of childcare is making it tough to go back to work for many parents around the country as the COVID-19 outbreak continues. Our guest says we really can't reopen successfully if we don't tackle that problem. Now, with the country talking more about systemic racism and its lasting effects, one example comes from the history of UW Oshkosh. In 1968-94, African-American students petitioned the school's president for a more diverse staff and curriculum. Those demands were rejected. After a sit-in, the students were arrested and later expelled. Our next guest says the effects of that decision are still being felt today, and the school needs to do more to make things right for those students and their families. Rajon Lynch, also known as RJ the Magician, is a Racine native and a graduate of UW Oshkosh. He's now the director of the Houdini Museum of New York. He started a petition to highlight this story from 1968. Rajon, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, how's it going? Am I clear? Can you hear me?
We hear you loud and clear, Rajon. How did you first become aware of these events in 1968 that came to be known as Black Thursday?
Well, I actually took a class at UW Oshkosh, and a lot of the classes have this requirement, or the teachers have the option to teach a class about Black Thursday and kind of about the repercussions of it, and about, like, you know, I took a rhetoric class, so specifically about, like, the communication and the rhetoric of the time and the lasting effects of it.
And you researched this and the students involved. What can you tell us some about who these students were and what they encountered on campus?
Well, they were just normal students, like, I guess, like me, but they were Black, like me, back in 1968. And they were the first students to really be allowed at UW Oshkosh or in the UW system in general, because the government said that schools, in order to get funding, had to integrate. So they really kind of searched for these Black students, and that was kind of the start of how they got there. But if you read a lot of their writings, which are actually archived at UW Oshkosh, and again, I'm lucky that I got a chance to be in this class, because not every teacher or professor had to teach this. But when you start to read their writings, they talk about how they were, like, spit at, how they were called monkeys, all these different, like, you know, typical things. But it really, the main thing was when they were expelled.
And also, they encountered some of them. There was an official, a bursar or something, who refused to give them their financial aid checks.
You know, I'm not actually sure about that.
I thought I'd see that.
Something I don't know about exactly. But there's a lot of things that contributed to it. Mainly, they wanted, you know, African-American professors. They wanted equal treatment. They wanted African-American history classes. You know, I don't know all the details of exactly what they wanted because I wasn't there. But I look into it as much as I can.
Now, what did they demand from the school's administration at the time?
Well, yeah, like I said, they wanted specifically African-American teachers. They wanted African-American history classes. They wanted representation, and they wanted to be treated like everybody else. And the school wasn't really a conducive place for that, allowing that environment. But they also just, when they wanted to be heard, I don't even think the chancellor at the time was willing to talk to them. They weren't even, like, you know, they sat in the office, they waited, and the chancellor was like, we don't even want to talk to you. And that's what really caused them to bubble up. And actually, they did do a protest. And again, we were always talking about peaceful protests. And they did a peaceful protest. They weren't being heard. So that's when they started to get angry. And they caused very minimal damage to the offices by, like, flipping desks and things like that. But they the school hyperinflated the amount of damage they did. They called the police on them and hauled them off in U-Haul trucks like animals. And they sent them to jail and banned them from ever stepping foot on the campus for, like, 30 years.
Talking to Rajon Lynch, he's a graduate of UW Oshkosh, and he's drawing attention to a story on UW Oshkosh's campus from back in 1968, where 94 African-American students ended up being expelled after protesting their treatment there. I want to give a listen to something that happened in the weeks after the students' cases were being considered in court, the Board of Regents deciding their academic future. Some of the parents of the students met with University President Roger Giles. Here's a listen to Francis Graham of Milwaukee talking to him in front of reporters.
We, as the parents, are requesting that our children be allowed to attend class until their cases are disposed of in court. All of them are not guilty of the offenses charged, and they should not be punished. Can you comment on that, please?
I would say that the subject is now before the Board of Regents. The Board of Regents will, I'm sure, move as quickly as possible to make whatever disposition of the cases they can.
Well, they ultimately then, as we've said, expelled 94 students. Can you talk a little bit about, Rajon, the impact that expulsion had on some of these students?
Well, you know, a lot of them, when you get expelled from a school, you can kind of see this in modern day, it makes it very hard to go to another school. And usually it's for bad reasons, but they, again, just wanted to be treated like people. So they couldn't go to a lot of different schools. A lot of schools wouldn't accept them. And a lot of schools weren't, like, UW Oshkosh is relatively open to this. A lot of people wouldn't accept extra black students to the school, and especially people who have been expelled. So a lot of them ended up going to UW-Milwaukee, which accepted them, but not all of them could. And some of them, you know, this is their first chance, their only time. It's hard to get money. They lost their scholarship. So a lot of them had to go to, not even go to UW-Milwaukee. A lot of them just had to drop out of school completely. So the thing that I'm essentially arguing is that the average person makes $1 million more in their lifetime, according to a lot of studies on the internet that you can find, and from going to college. So I'm arguing that if it's been two generations since then, my grandparents' age, I'm 24, so that's $2 million of wealth that's missing from a family. And that's directly because of UW Oshkosh, or the wage gap in Wisconsin for college graduates to non-college graduates today is about 61%, which is one of the lowest in the country. So that's it's just very tangible. It's very real that this is something that happened. So when my friends or people that would, before this time, when they were like, you know, your parents just didn't work hard enough, that's why they didn't go to college. Your grandparents just didn't. My parents are immigrants. It's like, no, they got kicked out, and this wasn't the only time this happened. Things like this happened, and even if they didn't get kicked out, it would ruin the taste of working so hard just to have what other people have. And that's my point that I'm making.
And you've got a petition going now. What are you hoping to see from UW Oshkosh now in 2020?
Well, UW Oshkosh and schools in general are going through a lot of funding problems. So what I don't want to happen is for people to blame this for coming for their money. But what I do want is for them to set aside a certain chunk of money for people my age and younger who had these grandparents specifically, like grandparents or a relative that they can point to and say, I didn't get to go to college, or I don't have money to go to college because my grandparents got kicked out. And I want those kids to be able to go to UW Oshkosh and have funding, and for UW Oshkosh to make this right. Because they have a lot of ceremonies and they give medals and they'll invite the ones back that want to come back, but it's not tangible and it's not monetary. And because these families are missing money, specifically due to UW Oshkosh, I want them to put some money into some kind of fund for these students to choose to go if they want to. And I also want specifically UW Oshkosh to the motto that we're saying right now is defund the police, because they have two police stations within half a mile of UW Oshkosh, one on campus and one off campus. And the one on campus has 15 police officers currently on the roster, at least online, that's what it says. But I know it's around 15 police officers. So if they even cut one police officer, specifically Officer T. Morgan is someone that has a lot of complaints about him, especially like race-related complaints. If they just cut one, that would be a lot of funding for a student to be able, or multiple students, to be able to go to UW Oshkosh for a subsidized amount because of this incident that happened and changed a generation.
And as we wrap up, you feel a connection with these students all at UW Oshkosh. You stumbled on another connection. One of the Oshkosh 94, Henry Brown Jr., had a family connection to someone in your field now of magic. Could you tell us that story?
Yeah. Well, so this isn't a new thing for me. I've always written about the history of black magicians. I'm currently working on a TV show about the history of black magicians, and this has been something I'm very vocal about because I think it represents the black community and the struggles we've had with entertainment. And specifically, I was reading it, and I saw the name Henry Brown, and I write about a guy named Henry Box Brown that was a slave that escaped freedom by shipping himself from Virginia to Philadelphia, and to white people that essentially helped him escape and become a magician for the rest of his life. And he's super famous, but no one knows his story, and it's very ironic. But I was reading this, and I thought, Henry Brown, that looks familiar. Like, I've written about Henry Box Brown, what if? And I read his story, I read his writings, and he talks about how he was from Milwaukee, and he talks about how he got his name from a potential, he thinks, because he can't trace it, because these things are hard to trace, but he thinks he got his name because he's a junior from his father, Henry Brown, who also got his name from the freed slave, Henry Box Brown. And he talks about how he didn't know much about him, but he thinks that that's where he got his name from. And I thought this is too much of a coincidence, because I've been writing about Brown for the last, like, 4 years, and I talk about him all the time. So when I saw this, I was like, I think this is something I'm meant to do.
Rajan, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
And one more thing, if I can. The petition is at change.org/Oshkosh68, so like 1968. So change.org/Oshkosh68. Please sign it. It'll go right to the chancellor, and I'm really trying to get this shared as much as possible.
Thanks again to Rajon Lynch, also known as RJ the Magician. He's a UW Oshkosh graduate, director now of the Houdini Museum in New York. He talked with us about the expulsion of 94 black students at UW Oshkosh back in 1968 and what he's hoping to see from the school today. Coming up, our guest says childcare is crucial to reopening the economy during the novel coronavirus outbreak. That's up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, millennials have weathered multiple recessions now in their lifetimes, and that's pushed back milestones, things like buying a house or having kids. We'll talk to an economist about how the recession caused by COVID-19 has added to that generation's tough economic outlook. First, in the best of times, finding childcare can be an expensive and tricky endeavor. But as the number of COVID-19 cases grew globally and states were forced to issue safer-at-home orders, parents had to take on the task of both providing childcare and working from home. Or parents have had to deal with the consequences of reduced hours or layoffs while caring for their kids. But now, as many states are reopening, families face the flip side of the childcare coin. A lack of options for childcare is preventing parents from going back to work. Our next guest took a look at how childcare is a crucial element in reopening the economy. Emily Peck is a senior reporter for HuffPost. She's also co-host of Slate's Money podcast. Emily, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure, it's great to be here.
You've been following this story for a while, Emily. Childcare is always tricky for parents, but how did COVID-19 really make things worse?
Well, I mean, primarily COVID-19 made things worse because childcare centers around the country closed and schools around the country closed, but not all workplaces closed. So parents around the country had to scramble, right? Some lucky people, the ones with the jobs who could work from home, are at home with their children trying to manage and juggle, remote learning and their regular jobs. And some of the women that I spoke to for my story, they actually have jobs that didn't shut down, but can't go to work because they can't do work from home, and they have to be home with their young children.
The country is reopening, but I know one concern all along is, are child care providers going to survive? Are they going to come back into business? And recent reporting from New York Times, at least one big national chain is closing a lot of its child care centers or furloughing them, things like that. So child care is not magically coming back as workplaces reopen. Is that what you're seeing?
Yeah, I mean, child care is this really weird industry in the United States, right? I mean, we don't have public childcare. These are privately owned businesses. And as I'm sure listeners have been paying attention and noticing that small businesses are having a really hard time right now during the COVID recession. Well, childcare operators are actually small businesses for the most part. There are a couple of bigger chains. And when they had to shut down, they stopped making money. And these are businesses that they need to generate revenue to stay afloat. So the longer they were shut down, a lot of them just can't reopen. They're going to go out of business. There's been a little bit of federal aid, but, not really enough to keep everyone going. And as this crisis has gone on, some places have just gone under. So it's been difficult for the industry to kind of, stay on life support, if you will.
Let's key in on that federal aid. Was it debated that much? Hey, should we be doing more to support childcare in this time when we're losing a lot of it?
Yeah. So back in March, I think, in the CARES Act, they did Congress, without much argument or debate, put about $3.5 billion into the childcare industry in the form of block grants to the states, which sounds like a lot of money, but the people who kind of pay attention to the industry estimate you'd need like at least $50 billion basically to keep the whole thing going. I think one estimate says $9 billion a month essentially to keep everything kind of afloat. So there are more proposals going around now, primarily from House and Senate Democrats to put more money into the childcare industry, but they really haven't gotten much traction so far. So I am not optimistic that there's more rescue dollars coming.
And you've written that you see this as a mistake. This is something that's a serious obstacle to the economy recovering, because it's one of the reasons that people, even when they can go back to work, might not be able to. Can you talk about how you see this affecting the economy as a whole?
Absolutely. I mean, particularly for women who are still primarily the ones that, taking care of young children, or the primary parent, you know, caring for young children, childcare is an essential to go to work. You can't go to work if you have another job to do, right? So if these childcare operators are allowed to go out of business and there's a real childcare shortage, then people won't be able to work. And the people that won't be able to work are going to be more likely to be women. They're more likely to be low wage workers, probably. You know, the people that can't just work from home, that's going to hurt the economy, because, you know, we're not going to be at full strength. And it will really hurt, I think, women overall. And we're already seeing in this crisis, women are facing a higher unemployment rate than men, which is very unusual. And I think the lack of childcare is definitely playing a role there. We'll see as more data comes out, you know, whether that really bears out. But so far, it certainly seems to be the case that the childcare shortage and sort of crisis in the whole industry is really impacting women, the economy in general, and women specifically.
Emily Peck is with us, senior reporter at HuffPost and co-host of Slate's Money podcast. She's been covering childcare during COVID-19. She says it's actually slowing down the economy, the lack of childcare, because people can't go back to work if they have to take care of kids at home and don't have options. You wrote a few weeks ago, Emily, about a looming possible collapse of the childcare industry. Now that we're actually almost a month left, you wrote that piece. What are you looking at now when it comes to childcare?
Yeah, that was about a month ago. And we're starting to see now some reports, you know, from different states of some places that aren't opening back up. I was just looking at a report. I was just looking at right before I started talking to you about some places that are opening back up, but the restrictions on how child care centers can operate during this time are a bit too much. And some centers aren't ready to reopen because, you know, you have to have fewer children. There's more onerous cleaning requirements and all that. I mean, we want all that, but it's too expensive for some of these places to open back up. So it's definitely something that I'm watching. And I think it's going to be different from place to place. Some places already had childcare shortages and sort of childcare deserts, you know, where people are on waiting lists already to get into childcare centers. And I imagine it's only going to get worse.
Former presidential candidate Senator Elizabeth Warren had a platform of trying to provide universal childcare for families. The idea has been growing a little bit, I think, in popularity. Do you think there's a need for an overhaul of that sort here in the United States of the childcare system?
Oh, my gosh. Yes. I mean, we know, everyone knows, everyone with young kids right now is confident that their kid, if they're in K-12 school, has a school to go back to. That's because we have, you know, a public education system. And of course, there's all things we would like to see improve in that system, but we're supporting the system with our tax dollars and making sure Americans have a good, safe place to send their children. Yet from 0 to 5, Americans are just on their own. And a lot of these operators are very small businesses, you know, on razor thin margins. And I just question why we would want to leave America's children in that kind of place. Why not give more public support to childcare and bolster the system? I think this COVID downturn has really exposed how necessary that is.
Now, you covered the recent jobs report, one that looked pretty good in terms of, you know, job loss is not as bad as we thought. But you pointed out one really worrisome spot: African-American women not recovering jobs. Is this part of the story, the childcare issue, you think? Is that part of what's affecting them?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, the data doesn't tell us that yet, but anecdotally, I wouldn't be surprised. I think African-American women were disproportionately represented in a lot of the industries that were most severely impacted by the downturn. And it sort of makes sense that they're not coming back to work yet. I think you can't discount discrimination that Black workers typically face. Typically, they can be last hired, first fired, that kind of thing. So if fewer workers are getting called back, that might be at play also. And for sure, the child care situation, I would guess, and I don't have it in the data yet, I would guess plays a role as well, yeah.
You mentioned the limited support from past congressional economic relief efforts related to COVID-19. Do you see this as an issue on the radar for policymakers at the federal or even at the state level right now?
I do, actually. I mean, I'm hearing all the time from lawmakers on the Democratic side and a few on the Republican side that do see the problem here. I mean, everyone wants everyone to go back to work, I think, safely, of course. And I have seen more attention paid to childcare in this crisis than is typical, because I think Americans at every income level around the country were all just really impacted by nationwide school closures and childcare, you know, closures. Every conference call I'm on, every interview I do, I typically hear like a kid, you know, like laughing in the background or a baby crying or something. I mean, everyone is kind of in the same boat right now in this way.
In our last few moments, Emily, before we let you go, what are you watching for next on the childcare story?
I guess I'm watching now how many can reopen and what reopening looks like. You know, with all these new restrictions, I think it's almost like a preview of what might happen in September with schools. You know, what do the coronavirus childcare centers kind of, you know, look like, the ones that are able to reopen.
Emily, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Emily Peck is a senior reporter for HuffPost. She's also co-host of Slate's Money podcast. She joined us today to talk about why a lack of childcare is making it harder for many parents to return to work. Coming up, we'll talk to an economist known as the serial millennial myth debunker about how millennials have been impacted by the economic downturns caused by COVID-19, the Great Recession, and more. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at 7:30 on The Morning Show, meet the new head of Wisconsin's Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection for a look at some of the biggest issues facing farmers here in the state. That's Monday morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the millennial generation has taken a lot of flack over the years, with some calling them lazy or entitled, others saying they've killed everything from marriage to the starter home. Our next guest says some of what's been said about millennials are outright myths, but other things have a lot to do with the fact that the generation has been hit hard by recessions and slow economic growth, including the recession the U.S. finds itself in right now. Gray Kimbrough is an economist at American University. He's been called the serial millennial myth debunker. Gray, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start by talking about who millennials are, because I think sometimes it's used generically to mean young people. Millennials, the oldest ones, are 39 now, right?
That's right. So the Pew definition for generations, which a lot of people sort of commonly use, is that millennials are those who were born from 1981 to 1996. So like you said, I was born in 1981, so I am a millennial, but I also, you know, am married with two kids, and I'm getting close to 40.
Talk about the economic growth we've seen by millennials and how it compares to past generations. You were quoted in a Washington Post piece that paints a pretty bleak picture for millennials when it comes to the U.S. economy as a whole.
Right. So when we were younger, there was a lot of economic stability. But as we've reached adulthood, millennials have seen rates of economic growth that are lower than those seen by people born in previous years. And so if you look at the 10 years after reaching the age of 18, the rates that all of the birth cohorts in the millennial have seen have been lower than almost every other birth cohort going back to World War II. And so In the Post article, actually, the author went even farther back. And you, if you compare it on a generation level, going back a couple hundred years, the millennials have actually seen lower rates of economic growth than their predecessors. And as you mentioned, we've seen multiple recessions. Started out, there was a recession in 2001 when the oldest millennials were reaching adulthood. And then there's the Great Recession that was very long lasting. And now yet another recession in their sort of prime earning years and early adulthood.
Can you talk about the impact of, say, coming out of high school or college into that recession job market? It's bad then, obviously, but from what I'm reading, it stays bad. You don't recover from that very quickly.
Yes. So other economists in particular have looked at the longer lasting effects of this. And so Kevin Renz, an economist at the Census Bureau, looked specifically at the Great Recession and the longer lasting effects of that. And he found the largest effects were felt by older millennials and younger Gen Xers, those who were in their 20s and early 30s in the in the worst parts of those of that recession. And so a lot of that has to do with, and what he hypothesizes is that people take a job that may not be quite as good as the job they would have taken in better times. They may be less likely to switch jobs to a job that's a better fit. And then that just sets you on a lower trajectory for the rest of your career, since all of your raises are often based on what your last job, what you made at your last job. Not taking a job that's a really great fit for you can really impact you for years to come.
Gray Kimbrough is with us, economist at American University. We're looking at the economic outlook for millennials over their careers so far. Not great in a lot of ways when it comes to overall growth in the United States, the timing of recessions in their careers. You could join in, by the way, at 800-642-1234, maybe with your own experiences or your questions for our guest, 800-642-1234. Now let's talk about life milestones, whether it's getting married, having kids, buying a house. How has this all been affected for millennials?
Well, so for marriage, we've seen not a dramatic shift for millennials, but there has been a shift over the over decades of people getting married later in their lives. And so that's just continued for millennials, but I don't see that as a very dramatic change. One thing that has been a bigger change, a larger shift, has been young adults living with their parents. And so after the, you know, in the wake of the Great Recession, we saw young adults, so people in their late 20s, early 30s, living with their parents at greater rates than we had seen since World War II. And that continued to rise and has basically held steady the past several years. So it hasn't really reversed the way we might have hoped as the economy recovered. It seems like a lot of millennials were unable for various reasons to really move out and start their own households. And a lot of that might have to do with housing, things like student loan debt, and other difficulties that have all compounded to make that tough for them.
We've seen accusations over the years that millennials, you know, aren't smart with money. The you know, they buy too much avocado toast and espresso. They hop around from job to job. I think we've all seen that kind of statement. How much reality is there? How much myth?
Okay, well, let me start with the job hopping, because this is the one that I think did get me branded the serial millennial myth debunker, because this is a myth that just really refuses to die, but is actually completely wrong. So I think a lot of this has to do with people always complain about young people these days. Mm-hmm. It's just something that they've done for, you know, forever. Okay, so that's you know, people are going to do that. But one thing that we notice over just in general, that young people being early in their careers are going to switch jobs more than people who are older, right? But if we compare millennials, their job switching to those at the same age of previous generations, we actually see that a 25-year-old millennial was switching jobs at significantly lower rates than a 25-year-old Gen Xer or a 25-year-old baby boomer. So it's just complete myth. They did not switch jobs at great rates. And this has actually been a problem for millennials, that there has been this just general decline in sort of dynamism in the economy. If you're unable to switch jobs, as we said earlier, you might be less able to find a job that's a better fit, get on a better career trajectory, that sort of thing. So just this decline in job switching has actually been an issue. But then somehow we've got this persistent myth that millennials are actually completely flighty and just switching from job to job, and you can't keep them on a job. Not really true at all.
And then the improvident avocado toast buying hypothesis of millennials' economic struggles. How about that?
Right. So obviously, food tastes change over time. Generations have different tastes for different things. But I don't really believe this is a key driver of millennials' inability to build wealth. One of the big differences that we see from millennials, they've had a lot of difficulty building housing wealth in early adulthood. So as I mentioned, we've seen a lot more of living with parents, of being unable to start your own household. I think a lot of that has to do with house prices being quite high in many parts of the country where young adults want to live. And a lot of that has to do with housing supply restrictions that older adults have put in place and have maintained very consistently through now. And that's made it really difficult to buy homes and start a household in a lot of housing markets. And then because buying a house is one of the main ways to build wealth, that has been a huge stumbling block for millennials to build wealth, much more, I believe, than perhaps their taste for avocado toast.
We're talking to Gray Kimbrough. He's an economist at American University. He's been called a serial millennial myth debunker. We're talking to him about how this recession and past recessions have affected millennials and their economic outlooks. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this you that we're talking about? Did you come out of into the job market during the post 9/11 recession or the Great Recession or now in the COVID-19 outbreak? How is this all affecting you? Have you had a hard time finding a job or affording a house, say, or whatever age you are? If you have thoughts or a question for our guest, you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about how this recession is affecting millennials on top of all the other recessions and downturns that generation has had to deal with over the years. Gray Kimbrough is with us, economist at American University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How has this downturn affected you and your financial stability? Did you come into the job market, say, during the Great Recession? How did that hit you? Do you feel like it set you back when it comes to things you might have wanted to do? Buying a house, for example, starting a family. Whatever age you are, you can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's bring on a caller now. Deacon is with us in Madison. Deacon, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Deacon?
So I myself am a millennial. I'm 25 in the Madison area, and I've noticed a lot of my friends, they don't job hop because they can't find work. They job hop because the work and the pay becomes much better when they do. And they found that sticking around at a company for too long really reduces the chance of raises. I mean, loyalty doesn't seem to be something that's rewarded in this economy the way that my parents at least talked about how it was when they were a kid. I was curious if that's something that's a generational difference or if it's something that is commonly found or it has been historically true and just not necessarily something our previous generations took advantage of.
Deacon, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Gray, you were saying earlier, millennials aren't necessarily or aren't, in fact, bigger job hoppers than past generations. But when they are, what do you think of what Deacon is saying about the motivation there?
Well, I do think that while millennials have not tended to job hop sort of continuously as they have a reputation for, we have seen a decline in people staying with an employer for a very long time. And I think that does speak to what he mentioned, that this sort of loyalty isn't really rewarded. Staying with an employer for 20 years is not going to get you the sort of career path that you can have if you leave after several years or 5 years or even 10 and go find a job where someone will pay you more. So I do think we have seen a shift in that part of the distribution, but people aren't, I think, job hopping at the rates that they have a reputation for.
Thanks for the call, Deacon. We'll go to David now in Eagle River. David, hello.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, David?
Yeah, well, you know, I just, I've been working ever since I was 14 years old, and I'm 24 now. And you know what? I just never had a problem finding a job. And I think that a lot of millennials, they just lack a drive. And I think that it's really important just to go out there and try for jobs that you don't ever believe in, that you could get. I got into carpentry, and I think that was quite a wonderful thing for me, because when I went there, I applied for a bunch of places for carpentry, and I've interviewed for three different places, and all of them said, well, do you know anything? And I said, well, no, but I'm willing to learn. And I think that people that have a drive and a desire to want to do something and to be with a company can get a job, you know, darn near anywhere.
David, thanks a lot for the call, and congratulations. Gray, millennials, David says, a young millennial himself, he says they should have more drive.
I don't have any great observations on that, on that, measuring the drive of millennials. I will say that for younger millennials, you know, this is really the first recession that they're experiencing. And if you've been looking for, so if you are 23, 24, the past 5 years have been a period of significant growth, but it's kind of basically gotten us back to where we were before the Great Recession. So this may be the first serious recession, the first big hit that that many younger millennials are facing, and we don't really know how severe it will be. But certainly for slightly older millennials who were already entering the labor market at a time when there wasn't significant growth, this is a second hit.
Thanks a lot for calling in, David. In our last couple of minutes, Gray, how about college-educated versus non-college-educated? What do we know about how those two cohorts of millennials have done?
Well, one thing we also know about millennials is that there are more likely to be college educated than previous generations. Obviously, that has been increasing over time as well, but it's been quite dramatic for millennials. And many people have made a big deal out of the fact that the college premium has been either holding steady or increasing. But a lot of that is due to real stagnation in salaries for non-college educated people. So it's one of those things where a college education has become pretty standard for many careers and expected in ways that it may not have been for previous generations. And so this is one contributing factor to a lot of millennials feeling like they have to work a lot harder to kind of reach the level that their parents or their grandparents were with less education.
And in just our last few moments, what are you watching for, Gray, as hopefully we recover from the COVID-19 recession and how it affects millennials?
Well, there's a lot we don't know about how this is going to play out. And so certainly a lot of it depends on how we deal with the virus and how we come out of that part of the impact, and then also the kinds of policies that we put in place to really make this recession as quick and less deep than it needs to be. I also am looking to so one thing that we haven't really talked about is obviously millennials are a group of people of the same age, but this recession is not impacting all groups the same. Even within millennials, there are certain groups that are in positions where they're just less able to weather these shocks. And so certainly for Black Americans who have even lower levels of wealth than white millennial counterparts, they could be even more impacted by this recession. So.
And we have to leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Gray Kimbrough, an economist at American University, talking about tough times for the millennial generation. You can find a link to a piece on this at WPR.org/centraltime. One of the crown jewels of Madison's downtown is in limbo. Nearly 2 weeks ago, State Street windows were broken and stores were looted after protests that started peacefully and ended in turmoil. Many remain covered in plywood, which local artists are covering with murals. For many, it's a healing process, but as Sean Johnson reports, no one knows what happens next.
The past couple weeks and the past few months have been a lot to process. Nobody's quite sure how to deal with all of this. The death of George Floyd in Minneapolis, the protests that followed, and the COVID-19 pandemic that continues. State Street is covered with plywood because for three nights in late May and early June, some people smashed store windows. Some stole merchandise. Some police shot tear gas. Some protesters threw rocks. These days, State Street is calm. Artists like Batenga Obuse are painting the plywood. For Obuse, it's cathartic.
Less pain, and it's better than being at home and just keeping this pain in. It's like, you know, coming out and release it, and release it in a healthy and positive way.
Obuse is working on a mural with her teenage son. There are handprints with the names of black people who've been killed by police. And there's a silhouette of a person with an afro whose face is covered by a blue surgical mask. Letters cut from red floral fabric spell out Black Lives Matter. Obuse says the past few weeks have been a shock. She says what's happening now is healing.
And it's sad that and unfortunate that it took the life of Mr. Floyd to, you know, to go through this and to have this, but it shows that deep down, ultimately, we really have a positive spirit.
It's not just the shops that are covered. A giant mural covers the boarded up windows of the Wisconsin Veterans Museum on the corner of the State Capitol Square. On one end of that mural is a picture of Malcolm X. On the other, which is being painted by Madison artist Lincoln Rust, is a picture of George Floyd.
I think it's good to put a face on what's going on right now. You know, it's right in the heart of downtown Madison, you know.
Rust's painting and many others were commissioned by the city of Madison. The city put out a call for artists, particularly black artists. Simone Lawrence answered the call. Like a lot of people out here, she says the last couple weeks have been tough.
You know, they've been pretty hard. It's taxing emotionally, mentally.
Lawrence is painting a mural of Colin Kaepernick, the former NFL quarterback. The mural's just getting started, but Kaepernick's figure is unmistakable. He's in his football uniform, and he's kneeling. But Lawrence says she's thinking about adding to that picture to show Kaepernick kneeling on a police officer, the way a Minneapolis officer kneeled on the neck of George Floyd.
And let people really think about what that means and what this figure represents, you know, should it be flipped around.
State Street business owners say it's great to see people coming back to the area, but a lot of them are just looking at the art from outside. They're not going in. Miar Maktabi owns the Dubai Mediterranean restaurant and bar. He was shut down for months because of the COVID-19 pandemic, and he was just reopening before State Street boarded up.
Last 2 weeks, worst 2 weeks of my life. The worst. I have never, ever felt that way in my life.
Maktabi, who's a Syrian immigrant, slept in his restaurant during the nights the looting happened. When someone broke his window, he scared them away by yelling and waving an antique sword that's a family heirloom. He covered the store in plywood after that, and the plywood got covered with a mural.
Personally, if you're asking me, I still respect each single mural that was painted. But me as a business owner right now, I'm covered, my whole place.
Today, Maktabi is removing the plywood. But at this moment, it's unclear when others will join him. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up Monday here on Central Time, Confederate monuments are coming down around the country, and NASCAR and other organizations are cutting back on the display of the Confederate flag. We'll look at the past, present, and future of Confederate imagery in the United States. That and look at some of the top news stories of the day. It's all coming up here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Keeley Baltina in for Kate Archer Kent. Monday at 7, Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call joins the show for a look at protests, police regulations, and lawsuits against the federal government. That's tomorrow at 7:30 on the morning show. Up next is news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then if you've got a lot of rhubarb you're trying to use this weekend, we have some ideas for you. The Wisconsin Homemaker joins us again to share some of her go-to rhubarb recipes. You can find them right now. Actually, we've got links at wpr.org/foodfriday. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.